Good evening. Welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. Tonight we're continuing our celebration of King Records with a rockabilly special featuring the King of Covers, Delbert Barker. Mr. Barker drove down from Franklin, Ohio to our studio on July 9, 2015 to talk with music historian and King Records expert Brian Powers about his career. Tonight you'll hear Delbert's memories of working in television and his love of country music, which led to his recording sessions, including some in 1956 and 1966 at King Records. Most of the songs that you'll hear in the next hour are from his album, Kentucky Hillbilly Rockabilly Man, on Stumper Time Records. Delbert Barker on the blues.
Back in the mountains, there is a town nobody has a clock. They just wait till the sun goes down and they know it's time to rock. Pie Pan Jeannie really digs a beat. Washboard Sam makes them shake their feet. When Joe grabs a jug, they holler, blow man, blow. Crazy about the jug band, rock and roll. The parson, the bootlegger too, horse thief Harry gets right. Never any trouble, don't care what you do, just want to rock all night. Pipe and Jeannie really dig the beat. Well, washboard Sam makes them shake their feet. When Joe grabs a jug, they holler, blow man, blow. Crazy about the jug and rock and roll.
My name is Brian Powers, and I'm a librarian at the Cincinnati Public Library, and I do a lot of research on local music. And today we have the pleasure of speaking with Delbert Barker, who's been living in this area for a long time, up in the Hamilton Middletown area. And he recorded a lot of country and rockabilly, particularly back in the 50s. So we're going to talk about his career today. Delbert, thanks for coming down.
Well, appreciate you having me, Brian. It's been a long time since I've been in front of a radio mic like this, but... it reminds me of some of the old times, you know.
Well, we want to start from the beginning. Can you talk about where you were from, your family, where you grew up, and how you came to this area?
I was born raised up to about 11 years old down in Frenchburg, Kentucky. That's in Menifee County. It's about 60 miles southeast of Lexington, right in the edge of the mountains, you know. And we had a little farm there. Wasn't much. And so we moved away from there when I was 11 and came to Middletown and settled there. And that's where I've been, that in the Franklin area ever since, you know, really. Except for a few years or so, I was in New Jersey and played with the Big Western Swing Band up there. And I moved away briefly then and worked with them, you know. So
when you were growing up, when you were a little kid in Kentucky, what kind of music were you listening to and how were you exposed to it?
The only thing we had was a small radio that we got to listen to the Grand Ole Opry or thereabouts sometimes when you get to work. The other times is there was a group of young men down there, boys, that played instruments. And, of course, being a small town, they had a courthouse like everything else. And on the courthouse, they had two runners that went out from the door like they were a concrete runner. And it was about 3 feet across and stood about 4 feet high. So we'd go over and get out and sit on those runners, and they'd play in the little alcove there. They'd play the music, and my brother was one of them. So I'd get to go over on Saturday nights sometimes when he's playing and get to listen to them. And we'd spend our quarter that we'd get for doing all the farm work for the week, see? And that way you could buy two hamburgers and a bottle of pop for a quarter and have a Saturday night.
So one of your older brothers played guitar?
Yes, my next oldest brother, yes. Well, actually, both of them played guitars, but an older brother. And my mother played some guitar and a little bit of banjo, and she would show us chords. And, of course, my brother, I'd go and watch all these guys play, and one of them played a fiddle, and a couple played guitars and things of this sort, and that was really amazing to me, you know.
And how old were you when you started playing guitar, and what kind of music were you playing?
Well, I started fooling the guitar when I can remember, really, you know. But when we moved on into Ohio, I got to listen to get me some records now. Then, you know, a little record player, and I could listen to the music that way and play along with it. And And I sort of secluded myself into the house whenever I got a chance and played with those records, you know.
I guess that was old 78 records?
Right. Yeah, and it didn't have anything like 45s or anything of that sort.
So what was in your collection then?
Yeah, I had a big variety. It wasn't a big collection, but the variety was big because you about had to buy what they had available and wouldn't necessarily have everything that you'd hear available. So, and plus the fact you didn't have the money to pay it. You had to buy one record a week or whatever, and that was it, you know.
And why did your family move from Kentucky to Middletown, Ohio?
Well, it was a work situation, economics, you know. We couldn't make much of a living down there on a small farm. And my dad had a little barber shop there, and he did some barber work during the week, and that was what helped support us, but he figured he could do better in Middletown.
Did you guys know people in Middletown, or was this a job?
It was just a job thing. Moved up there. Well, there were some people in Middletown that he knew from down there that had already moved up here, but that was really contact with them later, you know, met up with them. So
you're fooling around the guitar. You kind of learned the guitar and some songs. When did you start? Do you remember your first time you did like a live performance in front of an audience?
Well, I used to get to take it to school every now and then because I could sing in front of the class, and then I was scared to death then, even, you know. And they seemed to like it, and I'd do it every once in a while, and that was the first thing. Then a little bit later on, of course, being in the situation we were in, we could use all the money we could get. And then, of course, I tried to find a lot of jobs that I could do, and I had a newspaper route and various things to make a dollar, and there was a theater not too far from us called the Strand Theater in Middletown. In fact, about four blocks, really. And I went to the theater and got a job carrying the marquee up from the basement up so they could change marquees three times a week, and I get to go to the movies free. So that saved a lot of money that way. You could, you know, go to the movies wherever you want to, and so that was a good deal for me there. And during that process, they started advertising talent shows and contests they were going to start. And a fellow named Harris Rosedale in Cincinnati had a dance studio. And he was setting up these talent contests around the area, I think about 12 different theaters. Well, I got to watching the advertisement on it and thinking about it, and I thought, well, I don't think I could win it, but it wouldn't hurt to try. If I did, I'd make a little money on that, see? So it come time to do that, and I went down to the theater and had my best brogans and whatever on, you know, and my guitar, it was carrying it. I didn't have a case or anything for it. Got in the back there. And of course, the contest was for everybody. It wasn't just kids. It was for adults and anybody was there. But when I got in the back, that was a big surprise. All these people there were dressed up, and they had black shiny shoes on and tuxedos, a little bit of everything, you know. And I thought, Lord, how'd I get in this mess, and how do I get out of it? While I'm trying to figure out how to find the back door, they done called my name and shoved me out on the stage, and I didn't have nothing to do, but I had to sing, you know. So I did. I did my little number, and the way that they judged was by the audience. Everybody came out the end, and, of course, they went across and get the applause on each one, and I won the contest. And never will forget, got $5 and a little check sweater. So I take off home with that, and I tell my mom, I said, look what I got. And she said, where'd you get that? I said, I got it at a contest down to Strand Theater. I won it. She said, don't you lie to me. Now you tell me where you got that. I said, Mom, I'm telling you the truth. Well, what I didn't know was that after 12 weeks, everybody had to go back and compete again against all the winners of the 12 weeks. Well, I go back to the 13th week, and I'm in the same situation I was to begin with, scared so bad I didn't know my name or where I was at or anything. But I get out, and I do my little thing, and I won that. Well, then the final was down in Covington, Kentucky at a theater there that he brought all the finals from every theater he was doing down to do a finale, and whoever won that one got to go on his TV show. Well, I got to talking to my dad about it, and I said, I'm supposed to go down there, and he said, I don't know how we're going to go. We don't have any transportation. Well, it was like a month off or so forth, and in the meantime, my older brother went to work at Armco, and he had wound around and purchased him a car. So we decided to borrow that car. We borrowed that car and went to the theater down there. And I'm back in the same. I never did get over that, being scared. It's kind of stiff-like, you know, I was so scared. But I was lucked out and won that. That's how I got to go on the TV show. It went on after that about, I'm guessing, 2.5 years, maybe something like that. And WKRC at the time then started a country show on Saturdays from 10 to 11 o'clock. And they called, wanted to know if I wanted to be on the show. So I came down and did that show for about 6 months. It went off the air. And then there was about a year, year and a half lull in there, thereabouts, that WCPO started a five-day-a-week country show from 12 to 1. And they called. And I went down and went with that and started on that regular 5 days a week. I was there with them over 2 years. And in the meantime, Carl Burkhart.
Well, before we get into Carl, just real quick, can you give me a little bit of a timeline? Do you remember how old you were, or maybe what year when you first did that first talent contest?
I was almost 15, I think, at that time, or was close to 15.
That would have been about after the end of World War II, like 45, 46?
Right, yeah. And my brother was killed in service in 44, so it was right after that. Then I was in WKRC at 17. I remember that when I was doing the show there.
Well, what I wanted to ask you, though, was the one show that you did that you just mentioned that was on WCPO?
That was later. That was when I was about 19. I started on that.
I think that was about 1950?
Yeah, right, right.
Can you talk a little bit about that show, when it aired, and who you used to perform with, and kind of what you would do on that TV show?
Well, it was a midday merry-go-round, they called here, you know, and Big Jim Stacy was the MC of this show, and I think I've seen some write-ups on him, you know, in over the years. I worked with Big Jim, and the Davis Sisters was on the show with us at that time. That's before they went with RCA.
Right. And some people may or may not know who the Davis Sisters were. Can you talk about who they were?
Skeeter Davis and Betty Jack, yeah. Well, they signed with RCA while they were doing this show off WCPO, and they cut a hit record of I Forgot More Than You'll Ever Know. Betty Jack, unfortunately, got killed in a car accident, and Skeeter went on to Nashville and continued to record for RCA and had several hits, you know, out of that situation there.
So, as I understand, this show would air at lunchtime?
From 12 to 1 every day, 5 days a week.
So, were you on there Monday through Friday?
Right.
What was the format of the show? How long was it on? Like 1 hour?
1 hour, from 12 to 1 o'clock.
And so, what would happen in a typical show?
Well, they had several performers on that, and I was one of them, and I would sing. And also, I played some little bit of steel guitar with them every now and then, and guitar, you know.
Do you remember any of the songs that you were singing on that show? Were you doing any of your own, or were you just covering others?
It was all cover thing and a lot of Hank Williams material. I really liked Hank Thompson. I tried to do some of his, and then Carl Smith came along. I did his, and that was basically what, you know, the run-of-the-mill things.
So you're living up in Middletown, but you're driving down to Cincinnati every day to do this TV show?
Right.
And what kind of job were you doing here in the early 50s?
That's all I was doing was that, you know, because I did a lot of playing out, and I get some bookings off the show, and Al Schottelcott at that time was a newsman, and then Uncle Al and Wendy, that was another show that was on, and the Paul Dixon show came on right after us from 1 to 2. I would get, every now and then, Paul would get me to do a song on his show, so we'd do that.
That was the era of all live television.
Right, and Uncle Al would do some outside things, and I played for him, too, on the outside shows.
Where was the WCPO studios at that time, downtown Cincinnati?
No, it was up on top of the hill underneath the tower, on top of the hill over off of 71.
Obviously, that wasn't the first TV show, live television experience, but do you remember your first time doing live television, your first time you had to perform?
Well, the first time I did was when I won the contest, and I had to do the show with Harris Rosedale on his dance show. He had a program, I don't recall how many times a week, but he had the program where he taught dancing. So I got on that to sing a song, Scared to Death there too, you know. So that was the first one.
Did you do much outside performing other than that TV show with the Davis Sisters? Did you ever perform with them on an appearance somewhere?
Right. We had some, you know, not a lot of them, but I did probably half a dozen, at least a half a dozen, just local things they would be booked into, you know.
Wasn't there a place downtown called the Texas Club?
Yes.
And I think you told me you used to go there even before you were a performer.
Right.
Can you describe what that club was and who you saw there at the Texas Club?
The Texas Club was just a big dyke club and had a huge bandstand. And the bandstand was 4 feet high or better, you know, off the floor. And I would be fortunate enough to get to come down. My cousin had an old car. We'd get together in that, and we weren't old enough to get in the place, but we got in anyhow. We could stand over the side of the stage and watch the performers, you know, and Harry Adams and some of the other players that in that day was there playing. And so I'd get to watch those and whoever else came. And they had some of the more popular acts in the area to play there, you know, and it was just a typical nightclub.
So what kind of music was playing there? Was it country or was it other
sorts of things? Well, it was country, and they played some Western swing, you know, they'd have some of that in. And
when you were playing around the area, do you remember any? Was there any certain clubs that you played at? And did you have a band, or did you? Or was it just you?
I had
solo?
A band. We worked a lot of different places. We worked a lot at a place over near Richmond, Indiana, called the Buckeye Gardens. We worked at a lot. And the first places actually that I played was the Moonlight Gardens in Middletown. That of course that's been long gone, but that's one of the first places that we played at, and it has a little band. That's actually before I got on the TV shows. And my cousin played guitar and I played guitar, and we had a friend that played a big bass, upright bass. We didn't have any way to get it to the Moonlight Gardens, and he lived about a mile and a half, and we'd have to tote that bass through the cornfield over to Moonlight Gardens to be able to play, you know. But we draw a pretty good crowd.
So what was your deal for getting paid? Did you?
They would pay us, you know. We'd make a deal on how much it'd get. We didn't get a lot, but we got paid, you know. And the funny part about the bass, the boy played bass, it was his dad's bass. And his dad actually played in a group which was kind of a blues group. And he didn't know that his son was getting that bass out. But he'd get that bass out, and we towed it across that field, played to take it back and put it back. Well, it was comical, you know.
Would you play in Cincinnati? Do you remember any place that you played in the Cincinnati area?
I know I played some with Uncle Al in some of the places he played. His was more of a party thing or private parties, and we did a lot of those at the time.
So you're on TV, and then this guy, Carl Burkhart, sees you on TV. Can mm-hmm. you talk about who Carl Burkhart was?
Carl Burkhart owned a little label, which was called a Kentucky label. He had the Big Four Hits, which was the same owner of both of those. And the Big Four Hits is what he was interested in, because that was the 16 top hits of the day. He would do those and put them in a package and ship them all out to various places, because he had them advertised on the big radio stations like Chicago and Dallas, Texas, and Des Moines, Iowa, and those places. He was selling them as a package, and he wanted me to do voice on those songs, on different songs, which I did. No, I didn't do all the package. I did probably half of the package sometimes, you know, and then there'd be other singers do the other eight or whatever.
So what he was doing was he would have like cover songs mm-hmm. of popular mm-hmm. songs, and then he would get you to be sort of a sound-alike singer.
Right, right. And I did different ones, like Hank Williams, like I said before, Hank Thompson, Carl Smith.
As I understand, I think you did five different guys.
Yeah, and I probably touched on a couple more, which I really didn't do that well, so I didn't do any more of them.
But I think you were the go-to Hank Williams guy.
Right, right, yeah. I did a lot of Hank Williams. And, in fact, I did an album, you know. They brought out an album of Hank Williams that I did, you know.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling me a story when you performed down in Nashville one time. Wasn't it Bobby Bear?
Bobby Bear, yeah.
What year do you think this would have been? And you're doing a show in Nashville?
I went down and did some demo recording.
Would have been in the 60s?
Yeah,
maybe?
About 65 or 66, along in there. I went over to watch the Grand Ole Opry because I had some friends that was playing music there for the Opry, and we were going to go out to eat after they got done, because it was an afternoon show, Saturday afternoon that they did. And they got a break in between that and the night show. So I just went over and stood in the opposite wing over in the back of the old Ryman Auditorium there waiting on those boys to get done. And Bobby Bear was on the show. Bobby came off on my side and stopped and spoke to me. And I told him, I said, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but I love your singing. I've never met you. He said, I know who you are. And I said, well, you mind telling me how you know? He said, yes. When I got out of service, I came to Cincinnati looking for a recording contract. So I walked into a studio and stood in the control room and said, you cut a Hank Williams Memorial album. And said, I've got that at home. When it came out, I got it, and I've got it home. And that's my favorite album in the collection. You know? So that really floored me there.
Oh, I can't get you off of my mind. When I try, I'm just wasting my time. Lord, I've tried and I've tried. And all night long I've cried. But I can't get you off of
my mind. Didn't think you would leave me behind, but I guess you're the two-timing kind. Do you think that it's smart to jump from heart to heart when I can't get you off of my mind? Is blind, so you fool every true love you find. You got stars in your eyes, but they can't hide those lies. No, I can't get you off of my mind. Didn't think you would leave me behind, but I guess from heart to heart when I can't get you off of my mind. Didn't think you would leave me behind, but I guess you're the two-timing kind. Do you think that it's smart to jump from heart to heart when I can't get you off of my mind?
But he went on to say, you know, he said, are you doing anything now? And I said, well, a little bit of stuff. He said, well, if you need any doors open, you call me. And he said, I know how hard it is. And he told me how he got started and how many disappointments he had and things.
Well, where, Carl Burkhardt's studio, where was that at in Cincinnati?
On Spring Grove.
Do you have much memories of what the, how big the studio was or what was in there?
The studio was, it was a fairly decent size. It was not a great big studio. It was like a, maybe the size of a three-car garage and with a control room on the end of it.
And so when he would ask you to come down and do some recording, was it your band that was?
Right. Well, I bring the musicians with me. And,
so who was your musicians playing on those Burkhardt recordings?
We had some different ones, but the steel man was Bob McCoy out of Indiana. He played steel guitar most all those. There was an exception on two or three that he wasn't able to make, and I used somebody else. But him and my cousin, Ralph Barker, which has passed away now, played all the guitar stuff that we did. He did my Kings and this also, but he played all of that. The bass player was, we used a fellow by the name of Bill Apple on bass, and Billy Thomas was a fiddle man. Tug Swain played rhythm guitar for us, and basically that's about it.
And so when you would record one of these songs, obviously he must have gave you a recording beforehand, I guess.
Right, done some pre-work before we went in the studio, you know, pre-recording work.
Was it cut live or was it any overdubs? How was a session like at the Burkhardt studio?
Back in those days, there was no such thing as an overdub. You did it, and they recorded as you did it, and if you made a mistake, you could start back, you know, go over it again. Sometimes you go through the whole band, everybody makes a mistake one time, you know, once a time. I think the most takes I ever did on one was like 21 or 22 cuts, you know, so.
Was that your first experience in a recording studio?
Yes.
How did that go? Were you nervous about that? Or?
Well, no, not really that much, because we were more interested in putting out a decent product, you know, and he did have a good sound and put out a decent sound on the recording. It didn't sound like a fly-by-night operation. And it was as good as the majors, you know.
And this stuff would get distributed nationwide, I guess.
Well, it was worldwide, because I got correspondence from Australia, Germany, and different places that would send a letter in, you know, disc jockeys. I've been in touch with them, you know, different places too.
Now, as I understand, I don't think these were recorded under your name. They had different fake names?
All it was recorded under my name to start with. But what he did, he had some other labels that he would use on certain, I guess, certain different, you know, places he sold. In other words, when he went on that label, he would not only change my name, he changed the other people's names. It would be the same recording as I did originally under my name, you know. But he would change the name to, I think, to maybe sell more records, you know.
And I guess you just get paid like flat fee?
Session fee, yeah. Because I didn't write any of that.
Now, one of the songs I think you recorded was a Carl Perkins song in 1956. That was a big hit for Carl Perkins in 56. And so I guess Carl Burkhart wanted you to record.
Yeah, right.
Because before, I think you were doing like Hank Williams stuff, mm-hmm. a lot of country stuff. But now rockabilly is coming into
right.
onto the scene.
I did Carl Perkins. I did some Elvis.
Yeah, I think you did Heartbreak Hotel.
Right.
And you did Blue Suede Shoes.
Right. Blue Suede Shoes is the one that the collectors now, and I didn't know this till about 5 or 6 years ago, or a little bit longer maybe. Now the collectors is all looking for Blue Suede Shoes because it was selling so good. At that time, it was selling for like $200 a copy for a 45. And I didn't even have a copy of it. One of the collectors in Indiana was kind enough to bring me one. So.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of lonely streets, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be. I'll be just a lovely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be so lonely I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. And be so, that make you so lonely, baby, that make you so lonely, how they're so lonely they could die. Now the bellhop's tears keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, it's been so long on lonely street, they'll never, they never look back. And baby, so they make you so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, let's take a walk down lonely street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be making so lonely, baby. Where you will be lonely, you'd be so lonely you could die. Some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry back in the gloom. And be so, that make you so lonely, baby, that make you so lonely, oh, they're so lonely they could die.
The Blue Suede Shoes and Heartbreak Hotel and so forth, they got me listed in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame.
You're doing a lot of country artists, and you're performing a lot of that. And then rockabilly comes on the scene. Did you have any thoughts on when rockabilly, when Elvis and Carl Perkins was coming on? Did you have any thoughts about that kind of music?
Not really, but I liked what they did. You know, I really enjoyed what they did, and I didn't feel like I could do anything close to that. But it was close enough that they sold a bunch of it. You know.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show. Three to get ready, now go, cat, go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. You can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place, and do anything that you're gonna do. But honey, lay off of my shoes. Don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. My house, steal my car, drink my liquor from my old fruit jar, and do anything that you want to do. But honey, lay off of them shoes, and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes. Thank you. for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe. Well, it's a blue, blue, a blue suede shoes. A blue, blue, a blue suede shoes. Yeah! A blue, blue, a blue suede shoes, baby. A blue, blue, a blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off my blue suede shoes.
Now, as I understand that your recording of Blue Suede Shoes that got the attention of King Records.
Well, it was King Records. I did some country before I did the Blue Suede Shoes or did the rockabilly that I cut over. The first sessions was country. And then the next session we did was Goosebumps and No Good Robin Hood.
So do you remember when King Records called you up, who called you or any of that?
Louis Innes called me. Louis had come to King as their A&R man. And, of course, I didn't know Louis. I knew of him and had seen him before when he worked with the Red Foley and those people. And I really didn't know him. But I didn't know, you know, how he come about me. But anyway, he called and asked if I was it would be interested in coming down and talking to him. So I did. And went down and we set up deals then with King. And co-wrote some things with Louis, too, on did with King.
Now, one of the songs you recorded there at King in 56, I think it was in June of 56, the session, June 19, 1956, you recorded No Good Robin Hood.
Right.
Which I believe that you co-wrote with Louis Innes. Do you remember about how that song was written or any memories about that song?
Well, Louis had basically had most of the song finished, and he brought it to me and he said, I don't have the final touches on it, you know, and what do you need to record it, you know? In other words, does it fit me or can I do it or what did I feel like, you know? So I took the song and went through it and it came out fairly good. And I told Louis, I said, we could at least give it a try. I said, I think it might be okay. And he was well pleased with it.
Well, when you see my baby, don't try no funny stuff. 'Cause if she ever tells me, gonna make it awful rough. No good Robin Hood, well, that's too bad, gal I have. Well, that's a sad deep rockin' feel. A bad break, rattlesnake, she's mine, mine, mine. Porcupine, she's mine, mine, mine. I'll loan you all my money, the shirt off of my back. Don't try to take my baby, I'll really blow my stack. That's no good Robin Hood. Sad deep rockin' feel. Well, that's a bad break, rattlesnake, she's mine, mine, mine. Porcupine, she's mine, mine, mine. Well, you can say that I am stingy, say that I'm no good. Don't talk about my baby, I want this understood. It's no good Robin Hood, but that's a too bad gal I had. Well, that's a sad deal, a rockin' feel. And that's a bad break, rattlesnake, she's mine, mine, mine. Porcupine, she's mine, mine, mine. I'll loan you my jalopy, I'll help you with your chores. Don't ever get it in your head that my baby's yours. Well, that's no good Robin Hood. Well, that's a too bad gal I had. Well, that's a sad deal, rockin' feel. That's a bad break, rattlesnake, she's mine, mine, mine. Porcupine, she's mine, mine, mine. Well, that's a no good Robin Hood. Well, that's a bad break, rattlesnake, she's mine, mine, mine. Porcupine, she's mine, mine, mine.
And do you remember when you went to the King Studios, how was that studio different from Burkhardt's studio?
King was a bigger studio than Burkhardt's. And their reverb, they had a nice big, actually a reverb chamber that they use on a lot of their recordings, and Carl used what was called a slapback, which was just an echo. He put an extra playback head on the recorder, and when it would hit that playback head on down the line, it would give you an echo. And so we used a lot of that, you know.
With King, what musicians were backing you up?
There again, my cousin played guitar for me, and I used Steve Lake as a couple of his players out at Franklin, and Chubby Howard played steel guitar on a bunch of it for me. And they also brought up a fellow out of Nashville that was a guitar player, Grady Martin. But Grady come in and played fiddle on the session. He was a good fiddle player. And Louis brought him in and had him play fiddle for us.
Yeah, I think Louis Innes knew a lot of people in Nashville.
Oh, yeah, he worked with all of them.
Right. Yeah. And then another song that you did was called, I guess more one another rockabilly one, was Goosebumps,
mm-hmm.
which I think Louis Innes wrote. Any thoughts on that song? Or
no, it was a lot of fun to cut because of the way actually the song is written, you know, and I enjoyed doing that one, you know. But it didn't get a whole lot of airplay, really, you know. No Good Robin Hood is overseas now. That's the one that's been played the most over there, you know. And Goosebumps is second.
Devil, your lips say you're a saint. Sometimes I think I got your number, and other times I know I ain't. Goosebumps, cause you thrill me, baby. Goosebumps, how you chill me, honey. Goosebumps, when we kiss, I never had nobody shake me up like this. Runs me crazy. Can't nobody kiss like you. Goosebumps, cause you thrill me, baby. Goosebumps, how you chill me, honey. Goosebumps, when we kiss, I never had nobody shake me up like this. Don't know what it is that gets me, but every time it gets me more. Goosebumps, cause you thrill me, baby. Goosebumps, how you chill me, baby. Goosebumps, when we kiss, I never had nobody shake me up like this. Goosebumps, cause you thrill me, baby. Goosebumps, how you chill me, honey. Goosebumps, when we kiss, I never had nobody shake me up like this. Goosebumps, baby, 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 baby. Goosebumps, baby, 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 baby. Goosebumps, baby, 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 baby.
Did King, when they released some of these rockabilly songs that you did, were they trying to push you as sort of a Carl Perkins kind of guy?
Well, I really didn't. They didn't say that at the time. You know, they were trying to get the rockabilly period started. I mean, with some of the other artists too. I think at the same time, we had a period in there where Carl and Elvis, you know, was really going good, and I think everybody wanted to cash in on that. You know.
Yeah, I had talked to Bill Beach, who recorded some rockabilly, and he and Louis Innes brought him in,
right.
And he said that he had written these country songs, but then Louis was saying that they wanted them to be faster, so they kind of turned these country songs into rockabilly songs, because I guess that's what they thought was going to sell. So did you play out much with these songs? Did they get airplay? Do you remember much about any of the songs
recorded? They got some airplay, but I didn't do them out that much, because I was using more of a country band when I played out, and I didn't convert it over to the rockabilly because it would have been a situation where I have to change musicians, you know, in order to get the sound I wanted on.
And you continued to record for King, I think, for a couple more years, right? You did a few
sessions. Yeah, we did some sides there, and they're all out, you know. They're being played overseas quite a bit, but nothing here, you know.
Did you continue to work with Louis Innes when you did the recordings at King, or did you work with other producers?
No, Louis was the one I worked with on everything King.
I'm sure he oversaw the sessions. I was wondering, do you have any memories of what he was like when he was overseeing a session?
Louis was a nervous sort of person, and it was hard to tell what he was thinking because he was always moving, and he was always thinking, you know, so, but he wouldn't say anything. But if he had something he wanted to change, he'd let you know. A great guy to work with.
Did you ever encounter Sid Nathan, the owner of Kingman?
Oh, I've met Sid, yes.
Do you have any memories of?
Well, I just met Sid and spoke, you know, was introduced to him, spoke with him briefly, and I saw him a couple other times, and, you know, hello and how are you, and basically that's about it with Sid.
Did you have a first impression of Sid Nathan when you met him or anything?
He just sort of quiet, to me, was quiet kind of a guy, you know, and businesslike, and that was it.
Well, you were here for a little while in the late 50s, but then you ended up moving to Philadelphia?
I went to Philadelphia for a little while there and played with a couple in a nightclub in New Jersey. And I left there, and then I went north into New Jersey to Secaucus and went with the Warren Brothers, a big Western swing band there, playing guitar for them. Stayed with them for about a year, and then I came back to Middletown.
And then I guess you decided that, was it maybe you weren't getting enough gigs or something, but I guess you decided to get like a sort of a day job.
When I was working up in New Jersey, it was full time up there. And we did touring too. And the last tour we was on with the Grand Ole Opry people was 6 weeks and 6,000 miles. And I had 2 days off, and it gets rough after when you're traveling in cars, you know. I thought I'd try something different, you know. And I came back to Middletown and applied for police department and got it, you know.
And you worked as a police officer for how long?
26 years.
And you retired as a police officer.
Right. I retired as a lieutenant from the Middletown Police Department.
Did you do any kind of music when you were a police officer? Did you do much?
I stayed involved, you know, just to keep in practice and so forth. And during that period of time, I went to help a fellow out that was a writer back in the 50s with Acuff Rose, and he lived in Enon, and I went up to help him with some of his songs. He called me, wanted to revive 4 or 5 of his songs. I went to try to help him on that. He's going to take him to Nashville, and he said, if you got a song you can put on the tape, and I said, yeah, so I put a song on the end of the tape, and he said, now if I do any good, I'm going to give you half of this. I said, well, you don't have to. He said, no, I insist because you worked on them. I said, well, take this, and if you do any good, I'll give you half of it. So I You Almost Slipped My Mind on the end of the tape, and he took it down to Nashville. Well, that's the song that they liked in Nashville. So they decided to do it, and the publishing company wanted to change a couple of lines on it, which is normal, and they get part of it. So we went ahead and okayed the deal, and they put the song out. Kenny Price cut it on RCA, and that was a headline of his album. In fact, that was the name of his album. And it got some airplay, but it really didn't do that much. And about 9 or 10 years later, Charlie Pride came out with it and went to number one on January of 1981.
Just for a moment, you almost slipped my mind. She walked right up to me and took me by the hand. A woman who could please most any man. She said to me, I'm free, and you're just my kind. And for a moment, you almost slipped my mind. I could taste her kisses in the wine.
see now how sometimes a man can be so blind. Oh, let himself be led astray, become the cheating kind. I found myself falling for that same old line. And for a moment, you almost slipped my mind. Yes, for a moment, you almost slipped my mind.
Do you have a gold record on your wall now that they sent you?
No.
Record company?
No, it didn't get one of those, you know, because I didn't record it. I just wrote. It was number one Cash Box, two in Record World, and three in Billboard.
Well, that must have been pretty satisfying for that to happen.
Well, it's the only song I sent it to Nashville, and it went to number one, so I figure I'm batting 1,000, might as well quit.
The next thing I kind of want to talk about is, like, so you're retired. I don't know, maybe this started happening while you were still a police officer, but I guess these guys in Europe or start discovering all these recordings that you did here in Cincinnati, and I guess they contacted you somehow. Do you remember when you started finding out all these people in Europe were interested in your recordings?
Well, I got phone calls. The first magazine that came out with that, or the first one that contacted me, was the Rockin' 50s magazine out of Germany. And I sent them a write-up, and they used that, but then, in the lab, about 3 years ago, I had a nephew in Texas get hold of me. He said he'd been in contact with some people in Sweden, and they found out he was my nephew. I don't know how it was, but anyway, he found out he was my nephew. And contact him, wanted to get some information on me. And he said, well, why don't you just contact him? And they said, what? They thought I was already gone, passed away, you know. So he said, sure, I'll give you the he gave him the phone number and so forth. So they called. And we did a lot of correspondence over the telephone and also by email. And they came out with a big article with all the, and they researched all the records and came up with the records and put it in the magazine and so forth. In the meantime, Stomper Time Records was working along in cooperation with the magazine, which was the American Music Magazine. And they did an album of 32 songs of mine that I did.
Where is Stomper Time Records from?
You know, England.
And yeah. So they put out a CD of all your recordings you did.
Well, not all of them. They just put 32 because I had, Carl told me before he passed away, and he was going to send them to me. He had 5.5 hours of my singing on tape. So I got two cassettes, which was 120 minutes each, and almost full.
I may be wrong, but I thought I read somewhere you recorded like 100 songs for Carl Burkhart.
More than that, I would say. I think you did.
Maybe that's what got released,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. I didn't count them in the magazine here, but they've got them pretty well chronicled in the American Music Magazine.
So the CD, have you gotten more phone calls because of it?
No, it's sold overseas more than anything else, and I get royalties off of the No Good Robin Hood and things of that sort. And I've had, there was a label in, I think it was England, covered this about 2 years ago. It was one of their songs they put in their album, was No Good Robin Hood.
Oh, somebody covered that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
A couple of years ago.
You were a retired police officer, but you started performing again. Well, how did that come about?
Well, Middletown has a senior citizens building. They built a brand new one. And a friend of mine was out there, and they were talking about starting some kind of entertainment. And he called me, and he said, you think you could do anything on this level, you know, or with them? So I went out and talked with him, looked at the place, and so we made a deal that I would come out there two nights, like this Tuesday and next Tuesday, for instance, and, you know, that way, and see what we could do. And so they'd done some advertisement on it. And I went out, took the band. I knew a bunch of the guys that played and so forth, so I formed what I wanted as a band. Took them out, and both nights there was no seating or no parking left. People was turned away, and we didn't realize this, you know. They would draw anybody, but it did, and so they wanted to know how I could work with them, you know, and so forth. So we started doing two nights a month for them on Thursdays, up until last year. Now we drop down to one night a month. We still have 160 to 200 people every time we're in there.
And you do, like, two sets, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So my next question is, you think you might do any recording again?
Well, if it's left up to my wife, I would. She's been after me to cut, and I haven't done anything at all. But I've talked to some of the people that is in the business, and I've had offers of free studio time. I've had offers of free musicians able to play for me or whatever I wanted to do, and I still haven't come up with anything yet, you know. But I still might cut one. I've got some things that I might look at, but the problem is trying to get, if you want to get the right songs, you know. So I'm still thinking about it.
I just have one last question that I forgot that I wanted to ask about the King record sessions. Were they cut like they were at Burkhart? Were they right. Done live, no dubs, redubs or anything?
No overdubs. Yeah, we didn't have the luxury of having no, being able to have overdubs there. It was still two-track, you know. In fact, at that time, RCA was doing the same thing because I was in their studios down there. As they were cutting session, they had two-track machines run at the same time. One's a backup, you know. But they would run two of the big Ampex two-tracks when they cut their major sessions.
Was there ever a time that maybe you heard one of these King Record songs you recorded, like on the radio or on a jukebox somewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard them a lot.
Do you have any memories of a moment when that happened or anything?
No, just driving down the road and have the radio on and having to play, you know. And now, one thing I did when I was cutting for Carl, we did a copy of the Steel Guitar Rag, and I played steel guitar on it. And what we did at that time, we did a copy of Spade Cooley. He had the Steel Guitar Rag out, and WCKY in Cincinnati had a country show start at 8 o'clock every night till midnight. And their theme song was a Steel Guitar Rag that Spade Cooley cut. And they also sold these package records that we had on their shows. And every now and then that they would substitute my cut of the Steel Guitar Rag for Spade's. It's not as good, but it was close enough they liked it, you know. We'd hear that quite a bit, you know.
Was that Nelson King show?
Right.
Were there any radio shows in this area that was playing your songs, whether Carl Burkhart or King Records, that you remember, any particular station that might have played it?
Nothing except Nelson's show. They would play a copy of this and that and every now and then, you know. In addition to the Steel Guitar Rag, they would play other copies or other songs, you know. When I was younger, this was during the time I was right after I did the contest things. I got with a little local band, and we did a little local radio show there in Middletown on Saturdays, 6:30 till 7, I think it was, and Saturday mornings. And we would play a little radio show out there, you know, and work the radio there. They had two or three groups, like a 6 to 6:15 or 6:30, and then 6:30 to 7 group. And Jimmy Skinner and Ray Lunsford had a show. They would come out and do shows out there with us at that time. That's before, you know, Jimmy got his songs recorded by Ernest Tubb and those others, you know, and before he cut the contracts.
Did you ever go to Jimmy Skinner's store? That was he had one here in Cincinnati.
I was there one time, yeah, and that was all I got there. There was a fella, I can't think of his name now, that had a, I think he worked for Jimmy, but he went to Nashville and had a music store down there, and I can't recall his name. But anyway, it was just up from the Ryman Auditorium. And I was down there and been over to the Ryman. Oh, I know, I had my parents with me and my wife, and we walked over to look around the Ryman and was walking back up the street. And my wife said, "Boy, that sounds familiar." And he had a speaker out over the street playing records, and he was playing one of my records. I went up, and of course, I can't recall his name now, but I went up and talked with him, you know, and he knew who I was when I got up there. But he said, "Yeah, I played him quite often." But you never know, you know.
Well, I only have like one or two more questions, but they have to do with guitars. But okay. What kind of guitar did you play on like the Burkhart and the King Record stuff? Did you have a certain guitar? Did you have more than one guitar?
Well, the guitar I used most thing was my J200 Gibson. My wife bought for Christmas in 1952, which was one of the top-of-the-line guitars. I used that on about all my recordings and TV shows and everything.
And your cousin, you said, that was playing, was he like
playing
your lead guitar?
He played lead guitar.
I'm sorry, what was his name? Was it
Ralph Barker.
Ralph.
They knew him as Junior around Middletown. He was a great, good jazz player up there with a lot of people, you know.
And what kind of guitar did he play?
He was playing, at that time, playing a Fender Telecaster with me. And he kept that for a while, and then he changed guitars later and went on into Gibson and done some of those different Gibson Guild.
Did he continue playing in the area?
Yeah, right. He played with some of the jazz groups and around Hamblin, Middletown, Cincinnati, and pretty well known with them, you know. Good player.
he's not around anymore.
No, about he died about 5 years ago or six.
Are any of those guys that you play with, are any of them still around?
No, most of them are gone. You know, I played with them. So.
Well, thanks a lot for coming down here.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, Brian, and hopefully we'll hear this on the radio or something later or it'll do some good.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dilbert. I had a good time talking with you.
Thank you.
Don't give this beggar a shove. Begging and a pleading that you I'm needing. Starving baby for love. How about a handout? Don't make me stand out. Don't turn me away from your door. My heart's slowly dying. Can't you hear it crying? I need you like never before. I'll mow your lawn with scissors. Rake your leaves with a fine-tooth comb. I cut your wood with a pocket knife if you give this beggar a home. How about a handout? Don't make me stand out. Don't give this beggar a shove. Begging and a pleading that you I'm needing. Starving baby for love. This beggar a shove. Begging and a pleading that you I'm needing. Starving baby for love. How about a handout? Don't make me stand out. Don't turn me away from your door. My heart's slowly dying. Can't you hear it crying? I need you like never before. I'll mow your lawn with scissors. Rake your leaves with a fine-tooth comb. I cut your wood with a pocket knife if you give this beggar a home. How about a handout? Don't make me stand out. Don't give this beggar a shove. Begging and a pleading that you I'm needing. Starving baby for love. Starving baby for love.
That was How About a Handout, written by Dilbert Barker and Louie Innes, and recorded at King Records on November 26, 1956. You've been listening to a special tonight featuring an interview by music historian Brian Powers with Dilbert Barker, who's been inducted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. You'll find more information about King Records on our website, wvxu.org. I'd also like to thank Brian Powers, who helped with the music. I'm producer and host Lee Hay, and you've been listening to The Blues on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.